I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News, and along with St. Louis Public Radio and Reverend Willis Johnson, we welcome you to Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. We are in Ferguson for a conversation. We want to know what people here are talking about in the aftermath of the death of a young African-American man named Michael Brown. The country and the world watched this town erupt in sometimes violent demonstrations in the wake of that death, which came, as we all now know, after a confrontation with a white police officer named Darren Wilson. Many things have happened since, these 3 weeks later. We hope this is a good moment to ask those who are willing to be here about their ideas, their thoughts, their feelings about what happened and what should happen now. I'd like to begin by thanking Reverend Willis Johnson for allowing us to have this conversation in the church which he leads. He's going to help us hear your voices over the next 2 hours. Let me be clear that we are recording this conversation for broadcast. It's likely to be slightly edited for space. I've been asked by St. Louis Public Radio to moderate this conversation, and in that role, my job is not to take sides and not to judge the situation, but to help us have a good conversation. And by good, I mean a conversation where we can hear each other. Sometimes that can be hard to do when feelings run high, but I know that we can do it, and I know you're all going to help me. And Reverend Johnson, you're going to help me first, and I'm going to start just by asking you to offer a brief word of welcome to our broadcast audience as well as to our audience in the church.
We welcome you to not only Ferguson, but specifically a house of worship known as Wellspring. It is a place where we reach out to people to connect them to others, to grow them in their understanding, to offer themselves in service. And so tonight we do so to you and to this community. We greet you in love and in peace.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all. And thank you all again for coming. This conversation, as I said, belongs to all of us. And over the course of the evening, we're going to be hearing from people who are here present with us. We are also going to be hearing from people who are joining us via social media, via Twitter and Facebook. But we've also invited some leading voices in the community to help guide our conversation and also to hear from them about their thoughts about what's happened here. So joining us now are James Knowles. He is the mayor of Ferguson. Mr. Mayor, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Rita Days is a Democratic director of the St. Louis County Election Board. Many of you know her as a long-serving state lawmaker, Senator Days. I know that you're no longer serving in that role, but Senator, giving you the respect of your office. Senator Days, welcome. Thank you so much for coming as well. Daniel Isom is set to become the new state public safety director for Missouri beginning in September. He's a former St. Louis police chief. He's been serving most recently as a professor at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Chief, professor, director, sir, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And Kimberly McKinney is CEO of Habitat for Humanity St. Louis. Kimberly, thank you, and of course a longstanding person who's worked in the community in a lot of ways and has a lot of relationships that we think would be helpful to our conversation. Thank you for coming as well.
Thank you.
Now, each of you has comment cards on the chairs. You can write your name and where you're from. If you see your name on the screen, please proceed to the audience microphone. You can follow the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag BeyondFerguson. All right, I'm going to start by asking how you are. It's been a very emotional couple of weeks, a very difficult couple of weeks. So how are you, Mayor?
I'm well.
He's making a reference to his T-shirt for people who can't hear. It's the slogan of Wellspring Church.
Absolutely.
So,
remark.
You know, but are you really?
Absolutely. It's heartbreaking to see what's happened in our community, but I've also seen a lot of people come together, and so it's while this is a very difficult time for everyone in the community and difficult time for a lot of people across the nation, I'm happy to see our community start to come together, and I'm actually very happy to see a conversation started that should have been started long ago. And so I think, as I told many people when this started to erupt, that you know this incident here set aflame feelings that didn't start in Ferguson necessarily, but I think, and I think this is a testament to this, that we can hopefully end it here in Ferguson. So I'm glad we're having conversations. It was something that I mentioned early on at the first forum that we had at Christ the King Church, is that we will continue to have conversations because we haven't had enough conversations about some of these issues. So that is promising to me, and I do feel well about that.
We're going to talk about what you think the issues are, because I think many people might have different opinions about what those issues are, so I think we want to hear more about that.
Well, I'm also here to listen.
Of course.
Because clearly I want to know what people feel the issues are.
So. Okay. What about you, Senator? And I know you're the mother of at least one son, correct?
Yes, one son.
And I know that these events, like a lot of mothers of sons and daughters, but particularly sons, have been very difficult. Do you mind sharing what some of those thoughts are that you have through this?
Well, I'm troubled because I am old enough to have witnessed some of the things that happened during the civil rights movement, and it was disturbing that many of those things seem to be repeating themselves. As you said, yes, I have one son and who's 39, and so he has grown up in the St. Louis area, and I also have two daughters. But coming from the South, as I was raised, these things were very vivid to me, and so it looked to me as if we were regressing instead of going forward. And so that's disturbing because I have grandsons, and I don't want them to have to go through what, you know, I've gone through as a child and what, you know, the Brown family is going through now. My heart goes out to them because I cannot imagine burying my son. And so it's very tragic, and, you know, I just offer them the sympathy and prayers and condolences of, you know, of everyone. It's just unbearable that you would have to go through something like this. But it's real. But I do want to say that I'm very pleased that this is a conversation. I do not think this town has had a conversation about race. I think we have buried a lot of the issues, a lot of the feelings that are bound, and it makes it very, very difficult to move through life when you're harboring concerns and issues and they're not able to be brought forward. So I'm very pleased for the conversation, so I look forward to hearing what particularly the audience has to say. Mm-hmm.
Chief, what about you? What does this bring up for you? I mean, you have such an interesting background, both as a person who's been in law enforcement for a long time, as a person who studies a lot of issues related to law enforcement, and as a human being who walks around the street yourself every day. And just tell me briefly, what does this bring up for you?
Well, for me, I think it brings up frustration. Being a police officer for 24 years, I'm not surprised by the response of the public, because as a police officer, you work in areas that are challenged, that are impoverished, that have tension with the police, and you understand that there is a bubbling tension that goes on between the police and those communities. But also over a 24-year period, you know, I've seen so much loss. I've seen so much anger, hopelessness in neighborhoods. And so there's a sense of frustration that somehow we haven't been able to solve some of these problems.
You said you weren't surprised, though. That's surprising to me that you weren't surprised. A lot of people say they were surprised. Tell me, when you said that, what did you mean? You weren't surprised that people had as strong a reaction as they did to the death of this young man? What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm not surprised because, you know, for many people, they don't see the entire community. People only really see portions of the community that surrounds their life. As police officers, you see the entire community. And so you see communities in need. You see what they go through. You, in a sense, kind of understand why they might be angry, why they might be frustrated. And for police officers, you're generally on the ground floor. You're the face of government trying to hold it all together. And I think officers see it every day, depending on what neighborhoods you patrol. And they become frustrated because they seem to be the person on the front line trying to solve many of these social and economic problems.
Kimberly, what does this bring up for you?
For me, I feel conflicted. I think, you know, clearly there has been tragedy here that now, through the conversations, has presented an opportunity. And for Habitat for Humanity St. Louis, we're all about opportunity. For us, it's the opportunity to have home ownership, which, you know, entwined in the poverty issues and what has, you know, become race issues, is that we also have to make sure we're meeting basic needs, whether it's housing, whether it's employment, whether it's job training, you know, working with the police. The betterment of our communities isn't reliant on any one of those things. It's intertwined in all of those things. And working with the population that we do and knowing the challenges they face and knowing that all of our homeowners are not just first-time homeowners, they're first-generational homeowners most of the time, it really is, it's time for the change. Back to the comments that Senator Days made, it's time for our grandchildren, their grandchildren, to not have to experience this again.
You're already feeling very, tell me what you're feeling right now. You seem like you're about ready to cry. And I hope you don't mind my noticing that, but that seems true. What are you feeling right now? What's bringing that up for you?
I feel very, very passionate about what I do with Habitat. I'm also very embarrassed right now. I feel very passionate about what I do. I feel privileged to represent people who wouldn't have an opportunity. And I think we all need to take that really serious, the opportunity this has presented. I think the conversations we are having are great, but I'm going to equate it. I mean, we build houses, so I'm going to keep coming back to that. You know, the conversations are great, and we need to have them for as long as people feel like they have something to say and need to be listened to. But at some point, it's a little like doing community planning. We can plan a community to death. If we don't actually turn dirt, if we don't build something, then nothing changed. So I think I take that serious, and that's what fuels the passion. And I think you know, out of this tragedy, it's time for all of us to take that serious. Mm.
Reverend Johnson, you're in the truth-telling business, and tell us some truth that needs to be told right now.
Personally, and I think many in this community, in this room, their feelings, their emotions, their perspective have run across the spectrum. They've ebbed and flowed, and I know I've gone from feeling hurt to wanting to hurt, feeling helpless, even while I've been trying to help. And yet somehow in all of this, I think we all want to be and we need to be continually hopeful, but honest about the fact that we may not and don't really know how to do it by ourselves, mm-hmm. but somehow this effort, this exercise, this human work for a human cause requires us to do something, and it requires us to do something together that we can build on, whether that's the hope or whether that's the healing of the frustration or it's the assuring of the legacy and the heredity of what is right and what's promised.
Reverend Judson, why did this happen? And now let me just be clear that I was not there that day. As far as I know, none of the people up here was there that day. And this is a matter for law enforcement and other authorities to continue to investigate. So we're not here to litigate the facts of that particular case, but about why people reacted as they did. Why did this happen?
I believe that we have gotten to this place because at some point in the course of the afternoon of August 9th, action was taken that was perceived on to be necessary. And I think a lot of people are challenged to accept that, however you see it, that a death sentence is necessary for anyone or for anything. That's hard to accept. And I think it's hard for any of us to honestly accept that, that someone, another human being, has been lost. But more importantly, it then just, I think, unleashed all of the anger, all of the pain that comes with being lost or being feeling as if, more importantly, that you're not worthy, that you're devalued. And when we don't value life, however you see that for whatever reason, that is of critical concern for all of us. And I think you saw a reflection of that and have seen a reflection of that, a response to that.
Mr. Mayor, why did this happen?
I mean, I think as the pastor said, I mean, there's clearly frustrations, not just in this community, but across the St. Louis region, across the country. There's people who feel disconnected, people who feel disconnected from law enforcement, people who feel disconnected from the other parts of the community. And, you know, I think that when you saw, you know, this horrible tragedy take place, and so much of it, you know, was right out there on social media. It was very visible to see him in the street. I mean, it was shocking to anybody who saw it, to see myself, who wasn't there, but you felt like you were there because you could see all the images. I think that just tore the scab off of, you know, a wound that's, you know, been there across the country. And I think that's why we saw people come from all around the country to speak out. during these protests.
You know, you use the word disconnected, but I don't live here. But I've been here all day talking to people, and the word that I keep hearing over and over again is disrespected. Disrespected, demeaned, harassed. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I'll just tell you, within 5 minutes of our arriving in town, we saw a police officer pull over a middle-aged lady. And in the course of coming back to the hotel, we saw another police officer in the middle of a kids coming out of school, getting into an altercation. The first was Ferguson,
okay,
and the second was a nearby town.
Okay.
Used language that to talk to kids to break up a kid fight, mm-hmm, that I don't think a lot of us would have appreciated hearing. They use the F word with these kids. So the word I keep hearing is demeaned, harassed, and disrespected. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. Well, I think what you said, though, is a perfect example about how this isn't just a Ferguson issue. And clearly there's, I'm not a law enforcement officer, but I think clearly we need to talk about how the law enforcement interacts with young people.
Okay, but the Ferguson police officers work for the city, so can we just talk about that?
Well, right, but the instances you gave were about law enforcement in general. So it's absolutely not acceptable for any police officer, especially any that may be under the command of our city, to be disrespectful, to not show respect to anyone of any age. And if anything like that happens, of course, and it's brought to my attention, I'll absolutely deal with it. But I think there's absolutely, as you mentioned two different law enforcement agencies, and I think people who've come here from around the country will tell you that there's this divide between law enforcement and many young people. So there is a whole shift we need to look at about how we can better engage young people in law enforcement. We will be happy to lead that here in Ferguson, but I think it's something other communities need to join us with as well.
Let me ask you this. Fact check now, Jason. Were there solely young people involved in the protests? Jason was out there reporting.
Okay, it was a mixture of pretty much every age, race,
And what did they say about why they were there?
Well, it really depends. A lot of people came to Ferguson from surrounding communities and told me what you basically just relayed, that they felt disrespected by law enforcement, that they had been harassed by law enforcement, that they felt that they were unfairly targeted by law enforcement. And many of the people that told me this were African-American people. And this has been an issue for years, not just in Ferguson, but in many other communities where, it's predominantly black, but they have predominantly white police forces.
Can I ask a question about,
sure,
not just about, there are two issues here. One is the day-to-day street interactions.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I have for you as the mayor is a question of policy. One of the things that's come to light is that fines and fees are the second largest part of your budget. Second largest part of your budget. And is that the case? Is that a matter of policy that the municipal budget relies upon aggressive law enforcement to generate fines and fees? Is that the policy?
No, and actually, I was going to fact check you,
okay,
because there has been a lot of numbers being thrown around that has been stated about how much our budget has depends on law enforcement or fines and forfeitures. And in fact,
well, let me give you my source. My
sure.
source is the. This was reported by a number of news outlets, by including NPR, that the Arch City Defenders, which is a group that tries to mediate some of these issues, reports that last year that the city collected $2.6 million in court fines and fees. It was the city's second biggest source of income of the $20 million it collected in revenues. So the whole question of tailgate police, aggressive law enforcement, some of it's philosophical. Some people feel if you address the small things, then the big things get taken care of. But some people think this is a matter of collecting revenue.
Well, for us, it's not a matter of collecting revenue. One thing that we've always focused on in Ferguson is to try and, as you mentioned, focus on trying to make sure that small things don't turn into larger things. However, as far as our fines and forfeitures go, we just actually passed our new budget. It came up in June about how much fines and forfeitures are. And it was actually raised at that meeting that we don't want to become one of the cities, and there are many cities in St. Louis who are far worse as far as the percentage of their budget that depends on fines and forfeitures, some cities well over 50%, we made a statement at that meeting, we do not want to continue to increase the amount of money that comes from fines and forfeitures. Now, over the past few years, it has gone up, but that's primarily due to the fact that we started using red light cameras. And that was used simply as a force multiplier because we don't have officers who are able to sit at dangerous intersections and watch those intersections to keep people from running red lights, and it actually has helped in many cases with some of our traffic flow issues and some accident issues.
Are you aware that there is the level of resentment and anger about this that exists that we heard today with very little prompting? I'll give you an example. A woman named Ebony, who was interviewed by one of our reporters, Joe Shapiro, reporting for NPR, owes about $2,000 in fines and fees. She said she's been arrested before after she didn't pay off all of her fines, the last time just 2 weeks after she had given birth. Do you think that's fair?
I mean, I think it's very unfortunate. I would hope that she took the opportunity to contact our courts. We have on many occasions and continue to do amnesty programs where we allow people to come in, get a new court date. We'll wipe your failure to appear fines, which is what people are complaining about. They complain that they start with a small fine and they don't show up to court and they don't show up to court and they don't show up to court and they don't show up to court, and it balloons to a large fine. We work with people every year to say, come in, we'll give you a new court date, we'll be happy to wipe some of those fines away from you or some of those failure to appears. And so it's something that we continue to work with people on.
Chief, can I ask you about this? Can I ask you about this issue? Are you aware, have you been made aware that there is this level of resentment about fines and fees, is that people feel that it's not about law enforcement, it's really about money?
So a little discussion about sort of the history and eras of policing in America. In the 70s and 80s, it was considered to be sort of the professional era of policing, sort of just the facts. We go out and do our work, and a lot of police work was driven by numbers, how many arrests you had, how many tickets you had, and that's how people judge whether police departments were performing well. Into the 90s and post-Rodney King, there was this movement towards community policing, that police departments needed to be more engaged in the community, better partnerships, coming together and deciding how we're going to collectively keep our community safe. As we moved into 2000 and beyond, looking at New York, there started to be this movement in policing towards zero tolerance policing. If you deal with the very small things, arrest for everything that was minor, possibly you could avoid the big things.
What do you think is going on here? Do you mind if I ask that? Is it a matter of philosophy, this kind of zero tolerance, or what people call broken taillight policing, or is it money? And when you were chief, did people complain of St. Louis, not this town, but of St. Louis, did people complain about it to you?
Well, St. Louis, of course, is very different, and we spent more of our times on neighborhood issues than traffic. We had a dedicated traffic team. Clearly, our revenue was not very high in terms of traffic enforcement. But I will say that in light of zero-tolerance policing, hotspot policing, that we did put a lot of pressure on neighborhoods. We did a lot of enforcement, maybe not traffic tickets, but many arrests to try to control activity and problems within neighborhoods. Part of this is somewhat of a systemic problem, a greater problem. Now, I'm not saying whether or not they're using ticket revenue to support their budget or not. I haven't looked at the facts. But what I do know is that when you're poor, when you don't have a job, and you need means for transportation to get around places, sometimes you can't pay your property tax, your personal property tax. Sometimes you can't get your plates right. Sometimes you can't get your inspection right. And so as a result of that, people who are in those circumstances are going to be subject to tickets more than anyone else who has a job and who's able to pay their taxes, get their license plates, and all those things. Our system doesn't take that into account. You get a ticket, you keep getting a ticket, you keep getting a ticket. It goes bench warrant because you can't pay the fine.
That's not a law of nature. That's a policy decision to arrest people for not paying parking tickets. That's a matter of government. That's a decision. So tell me, and Reverend Wallace, I'm going to come to you next. And also, we've asked folks, Jeff Schultz has put a question forward, and A.J. Bell has put a question forward. So come on up, and while I'm going to ask, go ahead, finish that thought if you would.
So
and Reverend
I'll finish
Johnson,
the thought.
I'm going to ask you, too.
You're absolutely right. It is a policy decision. That people who don't have the means to pay their personal property tax, who don't have the means to, you know, pay for their license plate or even get a driver's license, that's a question for us. What do we want to do? Because the law says, this is what the law says, if you don't have those things, you get a ticket. And if you don't have those things, you go to court. And if you go to court and you can't pay the fine or you don't show up to court, it goes bench warrant. And this is the frustration of officers. We know that. We know a person who has multiple bench warrants, and we arrest them over and over again. And we ask, is there any way that the system recognizes that this person does not have the means to pay? That's a question for all of us to ask ourselves as citizens.
Well, we're waiting for Jeff. Are you there? And we're waiting for A.J. Bell. Where are you? Where's A.J.? A.J., are you there too? Okay, great. Reverend Johnson, I'm going to ask you about this question. We've raised two issues here, which is we've talked about fines and fees. We've talked about the economic pressure on people. We've also talked about attitude, people using language that none of us up here would appreciate being spoken to. What do you hear from the people who talk to you? What's their main beef? Is it the attitude? Or is it the issue itself? Is it the fines, the fees, the feeling like they're being shaken down?
Yeah.
Or is it the attitudes when people speak to you, they're not spoken to with an attitude of respect?
It's all of it, which could basically be summed up as insensitivity, both from the individuals in the system. It is, again, a concern of that we see people either as numbers or as issues, or we operate specifically by the letter of the law and not by the spirit of the law, which I know is hard to try to balance when you are on the front line as a traffic officer or even as a legislator trying to balance the needs and the responsibilities both to your community and to honoring what has been handed down through your various systems. But I think what you hear ultimately is insensitivity. And until we have some sensitivity training, and until we have some sensitivity legislating and community development that is sensitive, affectionately, as well as intimately wanting to deal with this thing, you're going to keep hearing that, because all of that is about respect.
Just briefly, can I ask the folks in the audience, have you ever, no matter who you are, ever felt that you've been treated inappropriately by the police? I'm particularly interested. Many hands go up. I see people of a lot of different backgrounds with their hands up, both people of color, people who are of European history, let's say. I see many hands. Are there people here who generally believe that police are doing an appropriate and a good job in this community, who generally believe they're doing a good job? You generally believe they're doing a good job? Yes? Okay. Good. You do? You do? Can I see the hands of people who believe the police generally do a good job? Okay. Can I see the hands of people who believe the police are generally respectful in their interactions with the public? Can I see the hands of people who believe the police in this area? I'm asking this area, because if you're from Miami, this is not what we're talking about today. Or, you know, another day. Do you believe the police are generally disrespectful in their communications with the public? I see lots of different hands go up. So, Mayor, that's something for you to consider. That feedback is for you to consider, I would think, how you interpret that information, because I can't. We need to take a short break. We hope you'll stay with us. When we come back, we will have more from Ferguson. And you can join this conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #BeyondFerguson. Please stick around. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. This is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Michelle Martin, and we are at the Wellspring Church with Reverend Willis Johnson and a distinguished panel of thought leaders from the area, including the mayor of Ferguson, James Knowles. You are also joining our conversation. You can follow us on Twitter using the hashtag #BeyondFerguson. Jeff, tell us what you have to say.
I appreciated everyone's comments up here, especially related to what this event was about in the larger sense of a lot of the frustration that I think people legitimately experience in terms of how policing happens and interactions with law enforcement officials, though they may be doing a good job in general. And a lot of that disrespect, the harassment, is invisible to white people like me. And that's a big problem. There was a story going around on social media recently that for white people, 91% of people in social circles are other white people. Now, maybe that's not true here in North County, but I have a 17-year-old son who's almost 18 as well, so this story hits me at an emotional level, too. His friend was over the other night talking about riding his bicycle home one evening, getting stopped by a policeman and being harassed about, where'd you get that bike? What are you doing in this neighborhood? Can you prove that this bike is yours? How many 16-year-olds are going to have a receipt for a bike?
Now, was this kid white or black?
A black kid. That's not going to happen to my son because he's a white kid.
Are you finished with that thought? Go ahead.
I was just, it's a real and a big problem that I think was highlighted and expressed through the protests and what we saw here happening over the last few weeks. One of the things the question that I was trying to get to is, a lot of times we hear about white privilege, and I understand that. And we're talking about discrimination, we're talking about injustice, we're talking about different ways of treating people based on where they live or the color of their skin. My question is there a maybe more helpful way to talk about that injustice? Because my concern is the language of privilege puts white people on the defensive. It makes white people feel like we're being accused of getting away with something when I think we're talking about human rights and human dignity that's not a limited resource. So my making sure that other people are treated fairly and treated with dignity does not take anything away from me, and it's something that we should all be engaged in working towards. So my concern is that, honestly, if white people are the ones who typically in our culture are in positions of power to affect policy and to make changes to along these lines, how can we do a better job of talking about the reality of injustice, discrimination, and disrespect in a way that will engage majority whites for whom that is largely invisible?
I'm going to hope that a lot of our second hour is going to be devoted a lot to where we go next. So hopefully I'm going to bring that up next, if that's okay. Okay, thank you for your comment. AJ, come on up.
Good evening. So we're talking a lot about traffic tickets and things that may or may not have a direct impact on what happened over the last couple of weeks. And one thing I noticed, I've been to about half a dozen events and rallies related to what's going on in Ferguson, specifically concerned about the community of Ferguson. And what I've noticed is that there is an overwhelming number of young people out there, and they are passionate about this situation and what's going on and what is going to happen, and having a voice in a way I've never seen young people have that voice. And I'm curious as to why there are no young people on the panel. I see young people in the room. I see young people in the room who I know, because I've heard them speak at other events, who were out there at night. We're out there in Ferguson. They've been tear gassed and they've been, running from the police. These are not thugs. These are not criminals. These are college students and youth pastors. And I want to know if we can give them the opportunity to directly tell the mayor, their experience, and give him the opportunity to kind of respond to why they were treated that way when they were peacefully protesting for multiple nights in a row.
Did you bring anybody with you who
no,
would like
I
to be heard?
This young lady right here.
Does she wish to be heard?
Yes, she will.
Come on up. Do you mind telling us who you are?
I'm Alexis Stumbleton. I'm 20 years old. I go to UMSL, and I live in Lake Pembroke, which is about 2 minutes from here. I don't know how many people are from Ferguson.
So. Tell us what your experience is.
My experience is pretty different because I live on the white side of Ferguson, which is by Lake Pembroke and Jane Ray Wabash and things. But I was also down on West Florissant, so I got to see the black side of things, and I do air quotations. So it's different to see how many people in my neighborhood who don't know about what's going on. They have no idea at all, and it's astounding.
What's so going on? Take this opportunity to tell what's most important for the mayor to know right now.
For the mayor to know right now is that the people that are up under you are directly taking our rights away. I can't explain to you that my First Amendment rights have been taken away, and that I have been told directly by a police officer that I don't have this right when I know for a fact I do. I was told that I did not have the right to assemble, and I know for a fact, you know for a fact, we all know for a fact that we have the right to assemble. The people working directly up under you told me that the Missouri Constitution, the state in which we live, where they are enforcing laws, told me and Devin, my friend, that in the Missouri Constitution, we are not given the right to assemble like in the federal Constitution. this is on video. This is what I was told. Okay. And I mean, it just gets as simple as that. And we can go further, you know, as to say we're being treated like animals, but that's the start. We don't have any rights right now. And that's what we're out here fighting for, things that we were given from the day we came out of the womb in America. And
do you want to...
You just mentioned that you have this on video,
and I
want to make this vow to you right now. Please get me that video, and if he is an officer up under me, I vow to you that he will be disciplined.
Okay.
All right
then.
Come on up, yeah. Sir. Come on up. Tell us your name. Do you mind?
I'm Jay Mitchell, CEO and owner of Jarts Entertainment, which has the purpose to illustrate and demonstrate the necessary needs of education through the performing arts to elementary, middle school, and high school children. Basically, this is to the whole panel because I had the same question about the purpose and why there was no one of a younger age on the panel.
Well, you know what? You're here now, so take advantage of the opportunity to be heard now. I mean, you know what I mean? Who's on the panel? Is that really as important as what's been said? What's said? So speak your truth.
Well, that's a portion of the truth. I say that only because there was an email that was sent out by someone who said that they did not hear back from the youth. And that's why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
I'm making mention because of the fact that, you know, they said, well, is there a voice with enough power who can speak on behalf of the youth? I'm sorry. We've been out there. We've been marching. We've been hollering. That's why I have no voice now.
But that's what's most important to say. You got all these people up here who have important responsibilities and who are listening to you. What's the most important thing you think they should know?
Take us seriously. That if you hear nothing else from me tonight, to take us seriously. I mean, in all necessary means of what I'm saying, you know, we've been hurt. And I look past this beyond just a racial issue or police brutality, because we also need to police ourselves, take responsibility for ourselves, but also in that action with the police brutality that has been going forward, to pay that attention, not just let it be an underlying issue, you know, that goes beyond the means of being swept under the carpet again. So that I mean, okay, if nothing else is said, to take us seriously and know that we are trying, and that this is a pivotal point that St. Louis is going to make a change that not only St. Louis will see, but that the world will see.
Thank you for that. You know, Thank you. The irony is, Mayor, you're one of the youngest mayors in the state. You were first elected as one of the youngest mayors in the state. Is it kind of surprising to you that so many of the young people in this community...
Now I'm old.
Well, feel that they are not heard at all?
Well, I have to say I understand that feeling. I was elected. You know, I started running for office. I was 24 years old, and nobody on a council full of 55 to 70, you know, between 55 and the oldest was 70 years old, cared what the 25-year-old city councilman said. That was until I became the senior member of the council, and then the mayor. I've struggled with that too. And I understand, I can't understand completely. I was young once. I'm not going to say that I completely understand. That's why I'm here listening to trying to understand. But, you know, a lot of people don't understand that I coach wrestling down the street, McClure South Berkeley High School. Every fall, you know, 30 to 40 African-American men, spend all winter with them.
I hear the frustrations from them too. We have meaningful conversations with that small group.
What do you tell them when they tell you that they feel that they are being literally hunted on the streets? What do you say to them? Have they ever said that to you, that they feel that they are literally being hunted on the streets?
It's never been put to me like that by any of them. Okay. I will say this. I always tell them this, first and foremost, if you ever have that interaction with a Ferguson officer, I can take care of that. And if you ever have that with any other officer, I think it's important that we take that to their department or to their city council as well, because that's absolutely unacceptable.
Nobody has ever told you directly a feeling that they were.
No one's ever said the words they've been hunted on the streets in my wrestling room. So,
okay.
But I hear that from people out there, and that's important that we hear those kind of conversations, absolutely, because it's important that we understand that there is that feeling out there so that we can do something about that.
This is... Well, hold on a second, because I can't really, actually can't even really hear what you're saying. So do... You're saying they're hiding behind the badges?
I think what they're saying is...
Somebody...
I could hear them. What was said was that there's officers who are hiding their name tags. And I know this because... And their badges, or their badge numbers aren't even assigned to them in Ferguson, so that's not... I think the concern that I've heard, not just in this room, but for the past couple of weeks, is that many officers have taken their name badges off. And I don't know that, but I do know that...
If we can't hear each other, we can't speak together,
right.
So I can't...
I mean, absolutely, it would be concerning. It's concerning to me that if anybody would have an interaction with an officer that they weren't able to then point out, that's absolutely concerning to me because...
Is that the first time you've heard this?
The first time I've ever heard it was this incident with the protesters and then the subsequent looting and riots. That has been brought up to me. That's never been brought up to me before. I personally, until this started, have never seen our officers not have their name tag on.
But let me ask,
I understand the concern there because clearly if they're anonymous and I can personally tell you what it feels like for people to anonymously threaten and everything else for the past 3 weeks, I've been getting it from all over the country. I can see the concern that an officer who can't be held accountable because they don't have a name tag on would be concerning to an individual they encounter. And that's concerning to me, too. So clearly that's something we need to address.
Senator Diz, let me ask you this. Nationally, we've been hearing about this disconnect between the city leadership, not just law enforcement, but the city leadership overall and the population that lives here. It's been noted by many people that the population of the city is far more diverse than the people who are in elected leadership, that there is that the police force is overwhelmingly white, that there's only one person of color on the council, and yet, we also hear that the voter turnout is extremely low in municipal elections, and I'd like to ask you about that. What's that about?
It is extremely low, and it's appalling that we have people who consider only the presidential election as important. We have people that tell us all the time, I only vote in the presidential. But when it comes to your mayor, your city council people, your governor, we just don't do it. Now, I will tell you that... in the April election, there was about almost 1,500 people that voted in the city of Ferguson. The population is over 21,000 in the city of Ferguson. So you look at the mayor was the only person he ran unopposed in that election. And so it's just an abysmal turnout when you look at this. And you have no other voice. And people think it's a cliche. This is the only place that you are equal to every other person in this country. And if you don't exercise the right to vote, then do not complain. Even young people, and there are major voter registration drives going on right now.
Okay, but tell me, why is it that people aren't voting? If they have this level of concern, why aren't they voting? And why is... all respect to you, Mr. Mayor, running unopposed. If there's this level of dissatisfaction with the leadership of this community, why is he running unopposed? Why is the prosecutor running opposed, which I understand many people have take issue with? They don't believe that he has the necessary dispassion. He was opposed?
In the primary.
Fall.
Yes.
Okay, so tell me why.
Well, people look at those positions. Some people feel that I don't have the money. It takes money to run for office. It takes a collective compassion you know, to actually run for office and put yourself out there. And I'm not sure a lot of people are willing to do that. Right now in the state of Missouri, we have term limits, so we have to turn over every every 2 years the House runs, and every 4 years of the Senate. But you have a maximum of 8 years that you can serve. And so hopefully, you know, that will bring other people in, we think. But if you don't put yourself out there to run for these offices, then these are the consequences that you have. People who have war chest, a lot of money. And so how do you go against them as a neophyte in this process?
I hear what you're saying. We have a lot of questions from the audience now. They're starting to come in, and we appreciate that. And a lot of them are about the police and and interactions with law enforcement. So, but there are a couple of factual issues that came up, and I did want to ask if Jason or Rachel has anything to say about that, this whole question of police officers particularly just not revealing their names or something. Do you have any insight on that that you can share?
I have a more specific question to the mayor, because you've said multiple times that if there's problems that you personally would take care of it. But I've read your charter and I've read your ordinances, and it is a direct violation of your charter to order any employee to do anything. So I'm just curious how you're actually going to follow through on it when your office doesn't really allow you to directly do anything with the police.
I wish you would tell that to Arch City defenders who, quote, misquote statutes and think I have more power than I have, because I don't. But I do have this. The city manager works for the city, or works for the city council, works for myself and the city council. And the dynamic of a city manager council form of government is that the city manager answers to us. Concerns that we have as council members, as the mayor, are brought to the city manager and dealt with. And of course, if they're not dealt with in a fashion in which we believe is acceptable, then, you know, we take that action with the city manager. I have a great relationship with the city manager. He is very committed to having a professional police department as well. I know that any concern such as that I would bring to the city manager, he would follow through with, and would continue to do so until the day he doesn't, and then he'd have to find a new job. So,
Emily Davis, can we hear from you?
Good evening, and I apologize. I had to write this down because it is a very emotional issue for me as both a mother and a human being. I live in Ferguson. I love a lot of things about Ferguson. I am the mother of three young children, and as Mr. Johnson mentioned, I have been through a lot of emotions. The first was deep sorrow, but now I'm angry. And I'm angry about what the police have done to my community and our residents here. I'm angry at the people in power who let the police terrorize and abuse our citizens, who have demeaned, harassed, and disrespected our citizens. And certainly, no one has felt either protected or served during this. And I need to hear some immediate solutions for improving community and police relations. When I walk down Florissant, my children and I have been out every day volunteering or protesting. And when I walk down West Florissant, I see the police in groups in their cars. I see them standing there waiting for something to happen. I see Captain Johnson out there shaking hands during the marches, but I still don't see any engagement. They're just standing there. And my kids are confused. My son said, I thought police were the good guys. And my feeling is that no mother should have to fear for her son's life every time he leaves home. And it breaks my heart that mothers anywhere, especially here in my community, have to feel this way every day. Not just Michael Brown's mother, but the mother of all those protesters out there just trying to make this better. And so, like I said, I need to hear some immediate solutions of getting the police involved and engaged on a level of respect for the community, because that is certainly not what we've seen.
Mark DeSantis, can you please tell us what's on your mind?
Sure. I'm a Ferguson resident. I've been living here for 2 years. And, you know, regardless of what your race is, your political background, I think everybody would agree that every police officer should have a camera, should have a vest camera, should have a dashboard camera. And what I'm asking, specific to the Ferguson Police Department, what date can I expect every police officer to be equipped with a camera?
Okay. Do you want to briefly respond before we take a short?
We just
we're not take a break. It's not really a break. We're just going to sort of lead into our second hour. Do you want to briefly respond,
Mr.
Mayor?
We just got 35 of them. Some of them are already in service. They are currently being trained on them. They shall be in service, you know, expeditiously. I mean, they'll be right out. So. I don't have the date.
Police officers in this city will now be equipped with body cams. Is that correct?
The ones that are on duty. Like I said, we have 35 that we've gotten in. I believe there's 54, 53 officers, sworn officers. So they're not all out at the same time. So at this point, going forward, we're going to be having officers on patrol, people on the streets, people having interactions with the community. We'll have vest cams on, correct.
Okay. Reverend Johnson. We're concluding our first hour of conversation here. Just give us a brief thought, if you would, about is there anything you've heard here that you particularly want to highlight? Is there anything you really want to elevate that we haven't really focused on that you really want to think it's really important to pay attention to?
Well, I think, respectfully, our mayor has invited us to hold him and those that represent us in this community to task. And if there are things that they can address and there are situations that he wants to help us to resolve in a healthy way, in a positive way to move our community, then he's given us the charge and the invitation to do that. And I think that's what we need to do.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. I'm Michelle Martin from NPR News. I'm here with St. Louis Public Radio, which is convening this event at the Wellspring Church with Reverend Willis Johnson and a distinguished panel of guests. Kimberly McKinney, she's the CEO of Habitat for Humanity St. Louis. Daniel Isom II has now been named the Director of Public Safety for the state of Missouri. He's a former police chief from St. Louis. And Rita Days, former state senator, is a leading political figure here. We're all here at Wellspring Church. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more from Ferguson. You can join this conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #BeyondFerguson, and we hope you will hang in there with us. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News. This is Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. We're broadcasting from Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks again to Reverend Willis Johnson for hosting us here. This is a conversation that belongs to all of us, but St. Louis Public Radio has invited some important voices from the area to lead this conversation about what happened. We've talked a lot about that in the first hour. In our second hour, we hope we'll be talking a lot more about what should happen next. With us here at Wellspring Church in Ferguson are James Knowles, who's the mayor of Ferguson. Daniel Isom is a criminology professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's a former St. Louis police chief, and he was just named director of the Missouri Department of Public Safety. He'll be taking up that post September 1st. Do I have that right? So you don't even get Labor Day off. Sad for you. Rita Days is Democratic director of the St. Louis County Election Board, a former Missouri state senator. And Kimberly McKinney is CEO of Habitat for Humanity St. Louis. Thank you all once again for joining us today, for staying with us, and thank you to the audience, both here in this rather warm sanctuary and our broadcast audience as well. We are continuing to welcome your questions and comments, so you know, bring them on up, bring them on up. Don't be shy. We also were taking questions on social media. Rachel, is there anything you want to flag for us that we want to pay attention to, questions that are coming in?
There was one question we got that speaks kind of to one of the unique features here in St. Louis that anyone who lives here knows, and that there are a lot of very, very small municipalities that kind of surround each other, many of whom have 21, 22, 23,000 people. So this question came to us, and this woman asked, how does the bureaucratic and political system here in St. Louis County contribute to some of the problems that we see? I heard the mayor saying that it may not have been one of my officers because we're surrounded by all these different communities and different communities having to get on board with the same general program. So my question to all the panelists then is, how does the fragmentation in St. Louis City and County make dealing with the issue of segregation and racism in St. Louis more difficult, and does it contribute at all to the problem of segregation and racism?
Chief, do you want to take that?
Well, I don't know if the division in terms of multiple municipalities contributes to segregation in St. Louis. And so I think it's a broader issue about how we think about things. You know, our mindset and how we view people, what respect we have for people. Do we see a person as an equal? Those are the real questions. It's really not about whether you got six or seven different communities. It's about us and how we think about things and how we look at people who are not the same as us, who are different than us.
Senator Daines, what do you say about that?
I do think that to some degree it does contribute to the racism, because you look at the smaller communities, they are vying for dollars. They don't have enough money to sustain themselves, and so how do they do it? They go out and arrest all these people, or they give all these people tickets. You also cannot afford to hire the top-notch police officers, and so you're stuck with whatever comes along. We used to call them rent-a-cops. And so you have whatever, you know, if they graduated from the academy or wherever, you hope they have, but it contributes to that. You know, you also look at the fragmentation. You have different policies. In every one of these municipalities, you go down Natural Bridge Road and you're going to run into almost 10 or 15 different municipalities with 10 or different speed limits. And so you just go from one to the other and just hope you don't get caught in one of them. So I do think it contributes significantly to that.
We've talked a lot about what should happen now. So, you know, Chief, really, we've got to go to you here, because there have been so many questions about what happened here. And, again, our job here is not to relitigate the specific incident, but the way it was responded to, like, we keep hearing over and over again that the response of law enforcement here was offensive, and a lot of people feel escalated the situation. So I'd like to know if there's something that should have been done differently.
I think in terms of the incident that happened initially, the death of Mike Brown. Just in my opinion, it appeared as if the small police department was overwhelmed by the issue at hand, did not have the resource, did not have the knowledge to deal with an officer-involved shooting. And because of that, they had to bring in another agency. Whenever you bring in another agency, it makes an issue more complex, right? You have different people in charge, and you've got to coordinate activities, investigations, and that adds a challenge. So in that terms, in a policing terms, yes, division did make a difference. It made a huge difference. If St. Louis County was the police department who was involved, or St. Louis City, both would have had all the resources to start to conduct that investigation immediately.
But what resources are you talking about here? Are you talking about resources to secure the scene? Or what I'm hearing people say is that people acted as if they were in a war zone and treated their fellow citizens as if they were terrorists. And they're saying that that's what people are saying to us.
So we're talking once the protests began.
Yes.
Okay.
The only reason I'm limiting the conversation to that is that this is a matter that is under law enforcement investigation, and since none of us was there, I don't know that we can shed any light on that,
okay,
but we can shed light on the thing that affected a
right.
lot of the people
so,
here.
So typically, if I was chief of police, and I'll take sort of the Occupy St. Louis protests that happened across the nation, one of the things you want to do when people want to express their First Amendment rights is to reach out to the protesters first. You want to find the leaders in the group and have dialogue and communication with them right away. What you want to do is establish some ground rules. And I hear the young lady say, we have our First Amendment rights to assemble. Yes, you do. You have the First Amendment right to assemble. But the First Amendment right is not unlimited. That's been proven by the Supreme Court. So in this situation, if someone, this is always the case that's brought up for law enforcement, jumped up right now and said, there's a fire in the church, everybody run out, that is not a First Amendment right.
Okay.
So what you want to do is establish ground rules. Okay, we want everyone to be able to protest 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But there are certain things that we collectively need to do to make sure you can accomplish that. One is, we can walk down the street, but we have to coordinate that, right? Because people need to go up and down the street. You can walk down the sidewalk and you can assemble, but we need to make sure that pedestrian traffic can go back and forth. You can do all these things, but we must make sure that businesses can continue to do business. That's what you try to do.
Okay.
You try to reach out to the protesters and allow them to have their First Amendment rights with rules, okay?
Yeah, I think that people would like to hear from the mayor on this. Do you feel that something should have been done differently now that you've had a chance to think about it in the way that law enforcement here engaged with the citizens?
Well, I'll tell you this. So the first protest that started was just down the street here in front of the police department. And the first thing that our police chief did was go out and talk to many of the leaders, the clergy that were involved in that protest. And that protest remained for several weeks. It remained peaceful. It got large. It got small. It ebbed and flowed. And we were in constant contact, I think as the chief mentioned, with the leaders and kind of the organizers of that protest. And it actually... Okay. Okay, the
Hold on. Hold on. Let me just ask. What specifically would you like him to address? Tell me what you want to talk about.
Yes.
Do you want me to address the protest?
If that's what's on people's minds, then I think that's what you should talk about.
Sure. Okay.
That's fine. Because the actual interaction between the two of them, but I think that a lot of people want to know. They feel that Michael Brown's remains were disrespected, that he was disrespected as a person, that his family members were treated poorly, and that, can you speak to that?
I mean, I think as Chief Isom said, first of all, Ferguson obviously is a very small, relatively small police department. I shouldn't say very small. But, right as soon as this happened, our chief knew that there would obviously be concern that a department that has 54 people and conducts an investigation upon itself of an officer-involved shooting could not be transparent enough for the people to be okay with, could not be unbiased enough. And that's why we engaged a larger department that could do that and a separate department that would do that right away. Can I please finish? So
we have to.
So obviously, as soon as the incident happened, we contacted St. Louis County. And as far as the investigation goes, I'll get to the ambulance as well. As far as the investigation goes, unfortunately, he was left right there so that the investigators from St. Louis County, when they could get there, could come to a scene and investigate a scene of a potential crime that was not disturbed by anyone, because we didn't want anyone to feel that there would be any sort of cover-up.
Do you think this was handled appropriately?
I can tell you this. I think it's absolutely unfortunate that we have a situation where had we done it right then, taking care of Mr. Brown's body and moved him off the street and taken him away and tried to do the investigation internally, we would clearly be criticized for a cover-up. Now, we tried to be as unbiased and allow the investigators from the outside agency full access to everything so they could have a fair and impartial investigation. That precipitated him being out there longer than for a long time, and it's absolutely horrifying to the people who had to watch that. Now, I will say this. It is widely misreported that he was not given attention right away, and he was unfortunately pronounced dead. An ambulance did show up, and an ME, and there are videos that show this, did examine him and unfortunately pronounced him dead. So at that point, the scene was a crime scene. It was a crime scene that had to be investigated by a third party so that everyone involved could feel like that there was no cover-up, that there was no whitewash, and that justice would be done. And that's what we've been committed to from day one. Okay. Now, unfortunately, it precipitated an entirely unfortunate series of events, which unfortunately it was unsympathetic to those who watched. I mean,
have you ever, forgive me, apologized to his family for the way he was treated?
I have not had an opportunity, unfortunately, to meet with his family.
Why not?
Our chief did have an opportunity to meet both with his mother that day and express the condolences and the sympathies of our city and our department. We also have met with his family, and we've tried in the subsequent weeks to have meetings. Unfortunately, the family has sent representatives instead of coming themselves. But no, unfortunately, I have not had that opportunity.
Why didn't you just go to them? Please. Why didn't you just go to them and say, as your mayor, I'm sorry, and we'll look into this? Did that not occur to you?
We've invited them to come to us. We've tried to reach out. Absolutely. Absolutely. The sympathies of the city and myself are clearly with the family.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Don't worry about it.
All right. These gentlemen, two gentlemen have been waiting very patiently. Yes, sir. Can I know who you are? You know who we are.
My name is David Jackson. I'm president of the Board of Education for the city of St. Louis. And, I started off by saying, I'm glad someone mentioned about Mr. Brown's body laying in the street for 4.5 hours. And I'm sure everybody in this crowd has something to say on many different topics. What this incident has done has raised an issue of unbelievable proportions in so many areas. Basically, in morality and humanistic nature of America. As a parent of two boys, it was so hard for me, 57 years old, seeing that boy lay on the ground with blood running from his body for 4.5 hours. His mother, less than 10 feet away on a sidewalk, that could not go to her son and hold her son. There was no reason in the world that that should have happened. I have talked to different municipalities as far as police agencies across the country, and I'm sure the chief could attest to this. There is no reason, no type of investigation, that that person had to lay there in the street for 4.5 hours. Where is the humanistic nature of not only the police department, but you as a leader, sir? You should have been the first one that ran out there. I am so disappointed in you as a leader. From your comments that you told not only your residents of Ferguson, but you told the world. The world was listening to you when you stood there and made the comments that you did. It's horrible. And so I even got responded on Twitter. The reason Michael Brown was killed by a Ferguson police officer, the buck stops with you. It starts with you. That's why your police chief came right behind and started another riot in your city because of his actions. And you did not say one word about him releasing that video, but about him not talking to the people that was placed in charge, such as the Missouri State Highway Patrol. You didn't talk to anybody. You didn't even remove the police chief from his duty. You had an opportunity to show not only this community, but you had an opportunity to show the world exactly what you were made of, and you didn't do that. Thank you.
Hold on. Can you hear that? Are you ready to respond? Are you ready to respond?
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
I think as already been said, I do not have the authority directly to remove the police chief. The city manager at this point is not ready to remove the police chief. The city council, the city manager, thanks to a law passed last year, signed by our governor, we cannot remove the police chief without a supermajority of the city council.
Sir, I wasn't saying to remove the police chief from his position as police chief. You should have removed him from any participation in this incident. You have the power to do that. You said it earlier.
Sir,
the relationship that you have with your city manager.
Let me correct you with one thing, though. We've been removed from this entire incident for over 2 weeks. The governor has taken over charge of everything that happened along West Florissant. The Missouri State Highway Patrol had command of the unified command that controlled all of what happened along West Florissant. Our police chief was not involved in the incident that occurred where pepper spray and rubber bullets and assault weapons were used.
That
equipment is not even in the possession of the Ferguson Police Department. And so you can say what you want, but I'm telling you fact. We do not have that equipment. We have not deployed that equipment. There are many agencies who have been assisting us since that Saturday night when the unfortunate incident occurred. Now, from that point on, the tactical teams were from St. Louis City Police Department, St. Louis County Police Department, Missouri Highway Patrol. Missouri Highway Patrol were the ones that brought in the big armored vehicles that the people are calling tanks. That is absolutely...
Hold on, that has been out of my control since day one. Hold on. We're going to have some fact-checking. Here from our reporter team from St. Louis Public Radio. Can either of you speak to that?
Okay. The police chief is directly under the control of the city manager in Ferguson. So that aspect, according to the charter, is what it is. But as you kind of mentioned, you have the power to tell the city manager what to do.
Jason, you know that there was a law passed last
year.
That's
Jason Rosenbaum, right? Of St. Louis Public
Radio. You know there was a law passed last year that the Missouri State Police Chiefs Association got passed.
Yeah.
Our governor signed. The Municipal League was absolutely opposed to. That does not allow the firing of our police chief without a supermajority of the council. Mm. You're familiar with that law, right?
You
cover politics in Missouri.
I do.
I'm just making sure.
Hold on a second. Did you guys want to speak? Go ahead. Let's hear from you. Can you tell us your names?
Hello. Good evening. My name is Beware.
Beware.
Before you jump to any conclusions, Beware means to be aware, to be conscious. Now, I'm from New York City originally, and recently a good friend of mine was killed by the police, and no one did anything. So when I saw what was going on in Ferguson on the news, I felt it wasn't my responsibility to go down and stand with my brothers because of what they was dealing with. The situation that they're dealing with is not just for Ferguson alone, it's throughout the country. And it's clear that there has been an covert war that's been waged against the black man in this country. And I don't care what anyone says that that's not the case, it's a conspiracy theory. The facts are laid out before us. And if it wasn't true, we wouldn't be here right now. Now, Mr. Mayor, as the elected official, it is clear that you failed to do your job to protect the community of Ferguson. You should be removed from your position because what you have done historically will go down as our ancestors and generations after us are reading this. They're going to see how you attack women and children and let that happen, and you stood by and you let nothing happen. Okay. That's not a man. And there's no disrespect to you, but a real man stands up for his community. That's why I'm in Ferguson right now. Now, you have some brothers here from the streets, and I'm hearing all these conversations going on, and no one's talking to them. No one's seeing what they're feeling. These are the brothers that get pulled over by police. These are the brothers that have to deal with the racial incidents and the racial profiling and the tear gas and the mask. And everybody's up here talking for them. And we have to let these brothers talk for themselves because they
are the ones
on the front line.
Okay. My guy, if you want to say this, is that essentially the same point, or do you have a different point to make, or is it essentially the same point?
My point is,
are you from New York as well?
I'm from St. Louis.
You're from St. Louis, okay.
Yeah. So where they call Ferguson, Missouri, but it's St. Louis too.
I got you.
But
can we get your name?
My name's Frankie. I be all over St. Louis. My question to you is you gonna step down? That's it. If you don't step down, you know how many people from the vote just to get you down, then that's going to stop you from getting anything else in our community because you done messed up everything for us, man. You ain't bring no help. You don't even know the kids inside the Ferguson district. They don't even know you. They ain't never seen you. Then you was saying on the news about I'm not in their shoes. What do you mean by that statement?
Well, thank you. A couple of questions have been asked.
So where do you live in Ferguson?
I stay on Canfield.
You stay on Canfield?
Yeah.
Okay. And one of the things that we've talked about from the start is that Canfield area, Oakmont, absolutely.
You.
Okay, sir.
Well, I'll tell you this. No.
Let him answer your question.
I'm not stepping down. So I will not step down from office. Yeah. The voters have an opportunity to relieve me when the time comes or recall me if they so choose. I have worked for many years with the surrounding communities, the local neighborhood associations, the residents here. I've lived here for 35 years. I coach wrestling here in the local schools. I've worked in the local schools in the classroom. So I do know many of the people here, most of the people here, and I'll continue to serve the people here so long as they'll have me. Now, if we haven't been able to reach out and touch you and your community, absolutely that's something we need to do over the next couple of years.
So why did this incident have to occur for all this to happen? When I had to get shot in the back. So that means I'm going this way, and they're aiming at me.
Who shot you?
The people you put out there.
Let me see.
A Ferguson cop shot you.
Were you really?
Yo, police, man. We was marching.
When?
Y'all said it was a curfew at 8. Y'all said it was a curfew at 12. At 12. We was out there at 8. On the front line, it was keys.
And what did they shoot you with?
What they shot me with? How do I know when they throwing grenades?
But again, so that's...
It's right there. Look at that. I got a mark on me. How many times do I have to deal with this?
Again,
I don't know what it is because they shot behind us where they trying to push us to.
And this happened during the demonstration.
Let me explain again.
How can you explain this?
The tactical teams. I'm glad to answer for anything that any of our officers have done. The tactical teams, those who are deploying those sorts of less than lethal weapons, are not Ferguson officers. They are not Ferguson officers.
The mayor knows who I am. I got him on camera saying that he wishes to step down if we so please. So for him to get up here now and say that's a lie. This is on camera.
Okay. Well, asked and answered. He's been asked if he will step down, and the mayor says he will not. So... And the election is in November, and I have been
in contact with residents from day one. There are the 22,000 residents in our community. I've been out talking to residents, talking to our neighborhood leaders. They have urged me to stay.
Can I just ask you to speak to not just what was said, but the intent behind it? And what I am hearing a lot of people say is very deeply disappointed that they don't feel you understand their issues, they don't feel you understand their circumstances, and they don't feel that you are feeling their pain. I mean, they've asked you questions and you keep talking, forgive me, you have every right to answer any question in the way that you would wish, but you keep talking about tactical teams, and what I hear them saying is they are very hurt, and they don't feel you are hearing their hurt.
I absolutely do, and here's what I want people to understand, and they're so far, I have not heard anyone listen to this, that the issues about being injured by the tactical teams, having snipers pointed at you, having assault weapons pointed in your face, having tear gas thrown at you, having rubber bullets shot or beanbags shot at you, I've never felt that, and I don't know that I ever will, but I absolutely understand the anger. However, I did not... However, it is important to recognize, that none of that was done by anyone under my command.
Okay, let me ask you this. Wait, hold on a second. Where were you when all this was happening?
I was at the police department most of the time.
Can't talk when we're yelling. Where were you when this was happening? You were at police headquarters?
Depending on which event.
When the tear gas was happening, when people were being...
Well, it happened over several nights. I mean, there were times when I was at the department, there were times where I was at home, but I mean...
You were at home, or you were at the police department, but I think the question is, why weren't you with your constituents?
I think clearly the situation was volatile, and an issue that law enforcement and myself and others have said from day one was that even interspersed between all of the peaceful protesters, there were, unfortunately, agitators who had come out to cause problems. We had asked residents to please come out and protest during the day. Please take your opportunity to come out and protest, exercise your First Amendment right. But then we'd asked people to go home by dark because, unfortunately, as the nighttime fell, some of the protests had been infiltrated by those who weren't out there for the same reasons, but to rather cause problems. That was something that we asked them to do. Clearly, I'm not going to go out against my own wishes in after dark to join something that we already knew was a volatile situation.
Okay. Reverend Johnson would like to be heard. Yeah. Reverend Johnson. Go ahead, Reverend Johnson.
Mayor Knowles, and please understand, I'm not trying to save you. I'm trying to save this community with this statement, because what is happening right now, if you can't feel it, it ain't because the air ain't on.
Well, you tell us.
The temperature is rising in this room.
Make it clear if it's not clear.
What you got to hear, sir, in all of this is that you're not going to be able to explain away everything. But it would help to start the healing process. It would help to unplug this pot that's about to boil over in here that will roll to the street if we're not careful, is the reality of acknowledging. Don't, and I say this with all due respect, I'm not trying to set you up, but man, I know you didn't do everything and it wasn't your police force or whatever, but acknowledge that what happened. That's the first thing. Because that's the first thing that most of these young people and anybody who was out there, we cannot deny what has happened. The second thing is, you ain't got to necessarily accept it personally, but we all have to accept, especially as leaders in this community, have to accept the responsibility to do something about it. And unfortunately, we can't keep pointing to other things or being convenient and hiding, because you've tripped yourself up. We were here about a half an hour ago, and you spoke real tough about all the stuff you could fix. And then the next thing you did when somebody challenged you was go behind the city manager. And I'm just trying to help you understand that, because that's what is boiling over in this room right now.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Mayor.
Reverend, I just acknowledged that I could never feel what went on out there. And I know I know that it absolutely has to be traumatic from anyone involved. Absolutely. Yeah. There's no tripping up here. What I said was, I will take every step that I can take. And that's why we're here.
is because I'm owning up to the issues that are facing not only our community but the region.
This is the first thing, though, to help it out a little bit, just condense it. We know what's regionally happening. Right. We know there's a rippling effect. Yeah. Okay. We want to deal right now with the fact that this is Ferguson. I mean, and every time, unfortunately, every time you say that, it's pressing people, it's piercing people, because then it gets us to a place where it's like, well, it's not really our fault, and even if we do something about it, it's not, I mean, and I'm just telling you what I'm getting on the side of my ear and what I've been hearing when young people have been in this church this week, when I was standing outside with them, and I know nobody's telling you to go run to the front line and get shot too, okay, because there's a lot of people in here yelling who weren't there at 1:30 in the morning, and I'll be honest, I wasn't there at 1:30 every morning, okay, but let's be real about it, and there's got to be a greater level of not only sympathy, but empathy expressed. And they're looking to you, even though if it's not your fault, because you're the leader. You're the leader. Well, you're responsible.
Yeah.
I'm standing here, and I'm sitting here with you, and I understand it because I'm running out there too. It's not my first cup of tea.
Kimberly and the chief have been dying to get into this conversation.
Okay,
poor choice of words,
no
but
apologies.
They've been eager to get into the conversation. And within the time that we have left, we're going to move along into what needs to happen. And so, Kimberly, go start us off.
Okay, respectfully to the mayor and as the only other white panelist, acknowledging white privilege and that you don't feel the rubber bullets isn't enough. It's just not. For this community to do any type of community building, there first is going to have to be a whole lot of community healing. And I appreciate that I was asked to be here. I think it was way preliminary. I love St. Louis Public Radio. I hope that they will reconvene a panel that is all about the policing issues, that there is the youth voice at the table, because it is desperately missing. It is time for this community, holistically, I'm not pointing out Ferguson, to listen with the intent of understanding, not listen with the intent to respond. And that's going to have to happen before there even is a what's next.
Okay. Chief? That was Kimberly McKinney. Chief?
So I want to echo what Pastor Johnson has said. And I'm listening to the crowd. And I think one thing all of us know is that Michael Brown should not have laid out there for 4 hours on the street. So you've got to acknowledge that that was wrong and that you're sorry for it, because just from a human standpoint, and if you want to just take it from a policing standpoint, it wasn't appropriate. I don't care under any circumstances what kind of investigation was going on. A person's body does not lay out in the street for 4 hours. So we got to acknowledge that. But the second thing that I'm hearing from young people is that we need to be up here speaking. We need to be talking. And the other part is that police officers need to be up here speaking and talking. The young Yes. people need to be sitting down face to face, expressing how they feel to the actual officer on the ground. We'll protect you.
We will.
We will be in the room as you all begin to build dialogue together. What happens, and what I've seen so many times over the course of problems with the community and the police, and usually it's youth and police officers, is we get in the room talking. And there's never that interaction between that cop on the street and that young person who is experiencing. And so I think as we move forward, we got to find ways for both of those groups to get together and have an understanding of each other. And I think that could be a powerful thing moving forward. Because only time they come in contact is when the officer is in an authoritarian position,
yeah.
Right? And that's no way to have a dialogue. That's no way to have an understanding. So that's something that I think we ought to be doing going forward.
We need to take a short break. We hope you'll stay with us when we come back. We will have more from Ferguson. And you can join this conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #BeyondFerguson. Please stick around. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News, and this is Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. We're broadcasting from Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. This is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, and thanks again to Reverend Willis Johnson for hosting us here. We have two more folks who want to step up. I'm hearing John and John Powell, and then Joe Pritchard both want to be heard. And then we're going to try to move into our final phase of our conversation, and thank you all for your for your patience and for being very real, but also trying to get everything out that needs to be said. So thank you. Go ahead.
I want to thank Michelle for being here and for KWMU and for all of you. I know this is probably unpopular to say, but thank you, Mr. Mayor, for being here as well. I'm a teacher, and I'm going to give the microphone, my time, over to a young person because I think this is really important to have young people speak. The only thing that I would say is that if we're going to go forward, and I'm interested in having more discussions about this, we've got to be more respectful of each other. And when we say we want an answer, that we will listen to people. Now, okay. Would a young person please come forward and take?
Go ahead. Tell me who you are.
Hi, I'm Janetta.
Hey,
and
Janetta.
I was out here. This is a church, right? So I have a testimony. I've been out here every day since what month are we in? August 9th, when Michael Brown was shot and murdered. I got out of my bed. I live across the bridge in St. Peter's. And I came down because I saw that baby laying in the floor with blood leaking out of him for 4 hours. When I got down there, the Ferguson Police Department were still posted across the way from West Florissant. Sunday, we went to the police department and the fire station to protest. It was peaceful, that's true. But there were still police officers, Ferguson, St. Louis County, who else is out there?
Highway Patrol.
Almost it was a few, it was multiple police departments out there with police dogs at a peaceful protest with babies and children in broad daylight early in the morning. How is that effective? If we are coming here to protest a murder and you meet us with police dogs. Not only that, it gets better. We go to a candlelight vigil Sunday evening. I can't even light my candle because we are coming down Ferguson Drive or Road, whatever it's called, and there are SWAT standing there with batons, they had the big guns, which Twitter had to tell me what kind of guns they were because I took pictures of them and I had no idea what I was looking at. But they were M16s is what I was told. They had the riot gear with the full body, everything at a, watch my language, at a candlelight vigil. Mm-hmm. The police were not invited to that, I don't believe, but you came to a community that is grieving for a child in riot gear, full body, and you wonder why riots or any type of aggravation or aggressiveness started. You all incited a riot. You did that on purpose. I'm not done, ma'am.
Is she talking too?
Monday night, the following Monday, I got shot while standing in someone's front yard trying to hand out water to the people in the mm-hmm. neighborhood protesting on Nesbitt, shot in my left shoulder with a rubber bullet. I've never been shot with anything in my life. Mm. I don't do anything that requires me to ever be shot. I have...
No, that's right.
I'm college educated. I don't do anything but mind my business. I came out here because Mike Brown could be my son one day. I don't have children, and I hope that no one, a police officer or any other, would ever lay my son out and have him 4.5 hours on the ground. That's why I'm mad and I'm involved. And not only that, I got shot. I got sprayed with tear gas about 3 or 4 times. We have that on audio, video. It's on Tumblr. I have notes on my phone, everything. The whole time while we were out there, all those nights protesting peacefully, the police were enticing an argument. I have my phone out, apparently a phone to Ferguson Police Department, St. Louis County, St. Louis City, and every other municipality that was out there, Fenton, all the way by Six Flags. What are they even doing out here? My phone apparently must be a gun because I have my phone out like this, and the armor trucks, I can see the sniper pointing it at me. I have my phone pointed at police officers when I catch them laughing and making jokes, and I take pictures of it because apparently you think it's funny to point guns at babies and children and toddlers. That's funny. Apparently that's okay. A joke.
Does your friend want to talk too?
Everybody.
Did she want to talk? Go ahead. Go ahead. Tell us your name.
Hi, I'm Ashley Yates. If anybody follows me on anything, it's Brown Blaze, because a lot of people have seen these videos. Mm-hmm. I just have a quick question for you, Mayor. What day was Ferguson PD pulled out?
Pulled off of West Florissant or off of, because we maintain the presence on South Florissant Road.
where the protests were across from the police department.
What day was their presence no longer involved with the
protests? Tactical Command, when the tech teams took over, I believe that was either Saturday night or Sunday night when the tactical teams took over. They had control. St. Louis County at that point had control.
What Saturday? Because we're going on 3 weeks now. I need you to give me a date.
We're going on 3 weeks now. When the St. Louis County tactical teams showed up and the Highway Patrol showed up, I'm not really positive who the command was on Saturday night of the incident.
But you are talking about when the Highway Patrol showed up, right?
Highway Patrol was there immediately.
Okay, watch this real quick. Hold on.
Highway Patrol was there immediately.
They were there immediately?
Yes.
Well, Ashley, why don't you tell us where you want to go?
Okay, Patrol was there.
My point with this is Michael Brown was murdered on August 9th. Mm-hmm. I was out there August 9th and August 10th. August 13th, when you shut down West Florissant, we were on Chambers in West Florissant, and we still got gassed. That was Tuesday. That was not last Saturday when the Highway Patrol came.
The Highway Patrol was there. The Highway Patrol officers and their tactical teams and the Bear, the big armored vehicle, was there within a day. So the command of the Highway Patrol did not take over, I think, until maybe that Wednesday, that 3 or 4 days after that. It was either Tuesday or Wednesday.
So who gassed me on Tuesday?
So, again, unfortunately, St. Louis County Police Department, Missouri State Highway Patrol was there. They were not in command, but they were there earlier, and so was St. Louis City SWAT. They were all part of the groups that utilized some of that.
Forgive me, Mayor. I think we want to... Ashley, why don't you move us forward? Tell us what you really think we need to know this evening.
I think what the Reverend was saying is true. We have to start with accountability. I have gone to so many of these, and everyone sits up there that played a part in it, that played a role, that has some responsibility to bear, and they beat around the bush. And everybody puts their hands up and goes, that wasn't my guy. Those weren't my guys. That wasn't my police. It was them. It was the other ones. So we have to start with the accountability. And if you're going to be a leader, I think you learn very early that when people do well, you let them take the response, you let them get the praise, and when they do poorly, you take that burden and that responsibility. You learn that. But everyone up here that's calling themselves a leader is shucking around, beating around the bush, and no one's telling us who was really responsible. We were out there. We know what happened. We got gassed. We got rubber bullets shot at us. We know what happened. We want to know why. Who's responsible? And if no one wants to take responsibility, we're starting to hold everybody responsible. Please believe me. I'm coming for everybody. And
what
we're serious.
Ashley, what does that mean?
We're serious.
But move it forward. What needs to happen so that a year from now we're having a different conversation?
The accountability and the acknowledgement of what happens. I'm sorry, I'm just going to say this real quick.
No, I want to.
Because I have not heard anybody talk about the community and cleaning up the tear gas residue that's there. That is toxic. That's toxic. But because you're not acknowledging the extent of what happened and how much you threw it down residential streets, it wasn't just West Florissant, but because you don't acknowledge that, you won't take that accountability, that responsibility. We can't even talk about how to heal because you won't acknowledge the hurt.
And I'm done.
Okay. All right, Reverend. Go ahead. Reverend Willis. Go ahead.
You know, we got to start now, and I can't verify this because I'm not outside, but I just got a text message from my staff and someone from your agency as well who is watching Ferguson police officers outside right now, checking license plates. Now, again, I don't say this to be incendiary. I don't say this to incite anything, but what I am saying is this, is that from with that kind of understanding and what everybody is saying, how to go forward is first and foremost, we have to acknowledge that there is some sort of problem in this community. And yes, we may be operating under a hermeneutic of suspicion. We may be paranoid, but we got a whole lot of reason and a whole lot of record, not just in Ferguson, but in this country to be so. And so I just say that the way we go forward, we cannot, I'm sorry, Sister Martin, and this is not to raise up Wellspring or whatever, but tonight was not for the cameras. Tonight was not because we got an invitation from a good friend. This is what we have. This is what we will continue to do. This is what we're going to do tomorrow, specifically for young people at 6 o'clock. We have to continue the dialogue. We've got to continue to fight. And we've got to find a way. Again, this is not your doing or, you know, I'm not saying you're part of a conspiracy theorem or anything. No. But we do have to understand that people, if it ain't right and if it's incorrect, then I apologize. But on good source, this, and I know this because I live in this community. And, yes, I, too, have been stopped by the police. So I'm concerned. That's a concerning situation right now as we sit here.
We have time for one more person who wanted to speak. He was up. Oh, Mr. Pritchard. Go ahead.
I delayed mine because I thought it was more important for these girls to speak. I drove up from Festus. I was a teacher in the school system from which your governor graduated. Mr. Isom, I hope you and Michael Jones or somebody can help finish his education as best you can up there. And I've also been a musician for 50 years, and I want to tell you that there's two things that have political impact. One of them, of course, you organize, you vote, and you elect really good people that are going to fight for you. But there's a deeper thing about political impact, and it was, you might have read that they looked at all the music and how it affected people politically. The number one place went to Marvin Gaye for "What's Going On." And I think you need to keep an eye on what's happening with this mania of testing everything, which is affecting teachers and students, and when they should be getting a full curriculum that emphasizes everything they need to be, no, not just enough stuff to pass tests. And just fight as hard as you can for the good people you've elected to lobby for the best possible school, and you're going to have a better future for it.
Let's keep going with Dr. Higginbotham. Did you have a minute? We were talking about what needs to happen next. Joe Pritchard started off, Ashley started us off with what needs to happen. Ashley started us off saying accountability needs to happen. Joe Pritchard started off with saying we need to do a lot of things.
Mr. Higginbotham? This here is my third riot. I was part of the Watts riot, August 11th, 1965. It was in my backyard in Los Angeles. I was part of it when the night Dr. King was murdered, April the 4th, 1968. It was my 10-year-old birthday present. And I made a decision that night that I would find out why Doc was murdered, and I would develop a program, a process that can help rebuild our communities. So I've been on a mission for a while. And I came here to the city of Ferguson over about 2.5 years ago to talk with their economic development person, to share with them a bottom-up model that will close the income gap and address the social issues that are in our communities. And unfortunately, they said what you had is too powerful and it includes too many people in the process. And that's what we have shifted from an industrial-based society to a new knowledge-based economy. So we're in a whole new different system. This is what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. What programs or processes do you have in place to help the descendants of American slaves, because that's what it is, it's an economic issue, move them from the agrarian age thinking, their slave mentality, to this new knowledge-based economy to help the people be empowered.
That was Dr. Gerald Higginbotham, who's an economic development specialist. We are down to our last couple of minutes. It's been a very powerful evening, and I thank all of you who participated. I thank all of you who were here with your presence. I want to hear a closing thought from each of you. I want to hear what you think we need to do to have the kind of community that you want. Reverend Johnson, I'm going to end with you. So we're going to go this way. Mayor, thank you for coming. I know this wasn't easy for you. These are your constituents, by and large. I guess I have one more question for you before I ask you for your closing thought, which is, did you hear anything here tonight that really touched you?
Well, I think, you know, from the start, it's been hard to understand because, as was mentioned, I mean, I'm white, and I do have the white privilege, and I will say this. It is something that I've recognized. There's a great group in town called Focus St. Louis who does a leadership program. We spent an entire weekend talking about race as part of our program, and it's something very difficult for people to talk about. It's something, even as someone who grew up here, grew up as a member of a diverse community, not really seeing the difference because I grew up in a community, went to a high school that was, you know, 50-50, majority African-American. We didn't have the tension so much between us. So it was really hard for me to understand that until I sat through that weekend. I will say this. I do sympathize. I do empathize as best as I can, even with the background that I have with what's being said. And I hope people would understand that I clearly do want to reach out, okay? That's what I've done. That's why I've stayed in this community. That's why I'm active in the community, in the neighborhoods. That's why I coach the kids that I coach, and I dedicate my life to that.
What needs to happen now? And I think people would be particularly interested in what you plan to do to move the community forward.
Well, as the city council is currently discussing several initiatives that we would hope first that would bring back confidence not only in the city government, but also in our police department. Number one, establishing a police commission to help oversee the policies and procedures of the police department, a citizen-led commission. So that is something that we have agreed on. We are moving forward on, obviously, the dash cameras and currently the vest cameras to help bring back some of that confidence that have been lost with the citizens.
What mechanism also, do you have in place to hear from people who feel that those steps are not sufficient? What is their way of addressing this?
We have a great program in Ferguson called the Ferguson Youth Initiative, and we'd encourage anybody from Ferguson or anybody from the surrounding area to come and be part of the organization and help give back to us. We also have a student advisory board, the high schools and the schools here in Ferguson. People from those schools can serve as an advisory board member, a board of the city, to give advice to our community. And so the Ferguson Youth Advisory Board, the Ferguson Youth Initiative are all avenues that have been in place for the past couple years. We encourage people to come be part of that because we value their input, because we value them being part of our community. So those are in place. We encourage people to take advantage of that, be part of it, and we'll continue to move forward because we have to do a little bit more listening before we can accomplish all of what's been going on, accomplish the goals that we have. I will say this. I mean, anyone who clearly feels that they have been wronged, I mean, I would hope that you understand my sincerest apologies if you've been wronged. And so, any officer under my charge, I absolutely will again hold accountable. And so,
okay, all right, Senator Rita Days, can you what closing thought from you? What needs to happen?
Well, this has been a long night, and a lot of things have been said, but I think we need to get back to the basics of the fact that my people are not respected. They are not respected by police. They are not respected by any of the systems that we have. There's a conspiracy of division, and that's essentially what I feel right now. If you look at the schools, which schools are in trouble? Those are schools that with predominantly people that look like me. You look at our neighborhoods, you have differences. Your young lady spoke of Pembroke. That's the white side of Ferguson. She's absolutely right. But what does the other side of Ferguson look like? And not just Ferguson. All the other municipalities, it's a division. I have to look at white flight because you don't want to be in a community with the rest of African Americans, people that look like me. You don't want to be there. So you move out to wherever it is that you go. Pretty soon you'll be in the river. But you have to look at these things, and you have to acknowledge these things before we can even have a conversation on that. Okay. You look at where we shop. You look at our grocery stores in our communities, and you look at the grocery stores in Ladue and Clayton. They don't look the same. And so I think that before we move any further, we have to acknowledge these differences. And I think that's what the majority of the people want. Acknowledge it. Say it is happening. Say we need to fix that. We need to integrate our communities, our schools. It has to happen. Otherwise, you're going to have a division north that's going to be predominantly black, division south, and you're not bringing people together in that venue. So,
Senator Days, thank you. Chief Isom. Best wishes in your new responsibilities. I think that everyone here hopes that you will be successful in your work and your new role. Final thought from you. What needs to happen next?
So as I listen to everyone out here, especially the young people, I just feel sorrow. I mean, I feel sorry that, as a leader in St. Louis, that we haven't done a really good job. And so, I felt that it was my mission in life to address issues like this, but it doesn't seem as if that we've made significant progress. So I'm looking in the mirror. That's what I'm doing at myself to see what I could do better. And holding myself accountable. But what I will tell you is, even though you might be in a position of leadership, you need help, right? And so all the passion, all the ideas that are coming out here today, when people are pushing for change, you need to be out there helping them, pushing behind them. One person can't get this done. It has to be a collective approach. So I'm redoubling my effort to hold myself accountable and see what I can do to make it better. But I'm going to tell you, I can't do it by myself, and it has to be a collective group pushing for change.
Chief Isom, Daniel Isom. Kimberly McKinney, CEO of Habitat for Humanity St. Louis, a final thought from you. What needs to happen?
You know, I am blessed to represent a community building agency, and community building for us means a world where everyone has a decent place to live. A decent place to live isn't just the structure, the roof over your head. It's being treated like human beings. It's being treated like part of the human race, regardless of your race. I look across this, I'm going to start crying again. I look across this crowd, and I see such a diverse audience. This isn't a black-white thing, other than where we're dealing with all of the policing issues. I challenge this group to convene again, and it be the young people, and it be the cops on the street that Chief Isom spoke about. If relationships begin with talking with one another, relationships at Habitat begin side by side on a build site, learning that you really have a whole lot more in common than you have different. And until that bridge is taken down and those conversations take place, this isn't going to change anything.
Reverend Willis Johnson, you were kind enough to host us here for this conversation. Let me just take one moment to thank you all again. Thank St. Louis Public Radio for convening this. Thank you for inviting me. Thank all of our team from St. Louis Public Radio, my team from NPR in Washington. And Reverend Johnson, I want the last voice that is heard to be yours. You've been listening to Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. This has been a production of St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News. We've been here at Wellspring Church with Reverend Willis Johnson and a distinguished panel of guests. You can follow this conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #BeyondFerguson. We hope this is just the beginning of the dialogue. And I want to say again that I am grateful and humbled to have been included. If you invite me back, I will come. So thank you for this, Reverend Willis. Reverend Willis, a final thought from you, if you would.
Very quickly, I'm reminded of a story about a brother who was in a bad situation, and he got some help. He couldn't move. He was a paralytic, according to the story I read, and he couldn't move. He couldn't help himself. But there were some brothers, other brothers around, who realized that he needed some help. And they weren't doctors, but they knew where to take him to get some help. And so together, these brothers got together, picked up a mat, and went to a place to present him where he could get some help. And when he got there, they had some challenges and some things that they were confronted with. I hope tonight, the lesson that was learned in that story, I can't share it all, but tonight I hope that we have realized, not just by being here, but we will continue to realize that we need to dare to care. Our community's in trauma. We need not only to stabilize it, but we need to heal it. And it's going to take all of us grabbing at least a piece of the fabric of the work and carrying this issue, these problems, to the places where they need to go, where they can be resolved and addressed in a healthy and holistic manner. We've got to dare to care. Not only do we have to dare to care, we've got to defy convention. We've got to get out of this box thinking and this traditional ways. And matter of fact, that there's some things the way they are that are not right. We need to change them, whether that's politically, socially, whatever the case may be, economically. We need to dare to care. We need to defy convention. But most of all, we need to demonstrate some commitment. And just coming here tonight is not enough. Just going out in the streets for the last 12 or 13 days, going up and down, whether that was just holding your hands or throwing tear gas back or just yelling, is not enough. We've got a long struggle ahead of us. We've got great work to do. At the end of that story, they couldn't get through the front door, Sister Martin, because there was a crowd. There was a whole lot of people yelling, and they couldn't get through the front door to the source of the help. So they decided to go on the roof. They tore the roof off the mother, and they lowered their brother down before the help that could help them. And the story says that when the helper saw their faith, the man was healed. There's something that's going to happen when we demonstrate commitment. This community, this nation, this world will change and become better because of what's going to take place by the faith for Ferguson that we express, we exhibit, and we execute. So I am hurt. Sometimes I feel a little helpless, but I'm hopeful because I know there's a better day.
Reverend Johnson, thank
you. Audio from Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation is available online at stlpublicradio.org and is being distributed by PRX. Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation, is a production of St. Louis Public Radio.